Hi, this is Hannah Solomon in Rauner Library on Dartmouth College's campus. Today is August 20th, 2015, and I am here with Professor Hoyt Alverson. Thank you so much for being here.
I'm pleased to be here and hope I can be helpful.
So I'd just like to confirm for the record that you have signed the agreement,
Yes, and dated, yep, today's date.
Wonderful. Okay. And if you at any point want to take a break or anything, just let me know and we can pause the recording. So I'd like to start with some biographical information. Where are you from?
Washington, D.C. I was born and raised in a kind of scruffy working class, what then would have been maybe called a suburb, but was in fact a part of the city of Washington, D.C. called Anacostia, which has been in the news recently as having a lot of mean streets. It didn't have such mean streets then, but it was certainly a working class part of the city of the District of Columbia across the Anacostia River from the Navy Yard.
Got you. And can you tell me what your parents' names were?
My father's name is Elwyn, E-L-W-Y-N, Alverson. And my mother's maiden name was Myrtle Hall. Myrtle, like in the creepy ground cover and flower.
Oh, I think it's a beautiful name.
One is from what we would consider the North, and the other is from the South. So I had exposure to two different family histories regarding at least the recent history of the United States. One very much Southern Baptist, and my father came from what would have been considered the North. His grandfather fought in the Civil War.
Oh, wow.
And many other relatives, and the same on my mother's side for the Confederate States.
So was that sort of a family history that you heard a lot?
No, not a lot, but certainly my mother still had interest in a control of a farm in the South, which I visited in the summer. I didn't so much visit relatives in the North, one or two, but summers as a child, I'd often be farmed out, literally, to the farm. And so I got to know a good number of people on both sides of the family, and they were certainly very different, but would today have been called kind of salt of the earth, rather conservative. They're both from Appalachia, northwestern Pennsylvania, near Erie, and
okay.
South Central Virginia near the North Carolina border. So it's the Piedmont.
Yes.
They do share that in common.
Got you. Can you tell me a little bit what it was like growing up in the suburb outside D.C.?
This suburb was actually in D.C.
Okay.
One of the things which comes to mind in light of your questions and project is that when I was in the seventh grade, that would be 1954, the public schools in Washington, D.C. were integrated immediately. And at that time, the District of Columbia was pretty much a African-American city in regard to population, that is about half African-American, half Euro-Americans. And the schools were integrated, so beginning in the seventh grade in middle school, I went to integrated public schools. And that was certainly something which I was aware of in light of the fact that many of the people who lived in this working class inner city suburb left because of the lack of understanding of and or tolerance of African Americans in classrooms. So there was tremendous white flight, which our family didn't participate in. And so that was one feature that was certainly notable. And often, my visiting the farm in the South, my Southern relatives would say, "How I'm going to talk like I actually used to talk this way because of my mama and them." Anyway, they'd say, "Hoy, what is the situation up there?" And that was always a code word for living cheek by jowl. And in a little later in the neighborhood, which became African American and white mixed for a good spell, but also in the schools. So they were very, Virginia and Maryland maintained segregation for some years after that. And that's where they, a lot of the neighbors went, was Maryland, and Prince George's County in Maryland, and Arlington County in Virginia.
Got you. Do you have sort of a memory of when you personally became aware of the civil rights movement, or of, you know, the actual social shift that was going on?
I certainly became aware of it pretty much immediately because it was a very hot topic in the news. My parents talked about it, my father more than my mother. So it was definitely a topic around the table. And also, I can't remember the exact year, we moved our residence, still within the southeast Anacostia area, from one house to another, because the school that I would have gone to, where I was born, from the house I was born in, became somewhat of a... it was a real rough patch, mm-hmm. educationally. And I went to Anacostia High School, which was still... that wasn't Exeter or St. Paul's, but it was considered a cut above Eastern High School, where I would have gone. So the moving of the house engenders a lot of conversation. And the topic of civil rights was very much current in the papers. Mm-hmm. Back then, my parents, as you would guess, read papers, even though they were not highly educated, but they did subscribe to the two D.C. papers. And there was lots of buzz among my peers about school integration. So that would have been in middle school. And gotcha. That continued.
So then, can you describe a little bit of your high school experience for me?
Anacostia High School was a mixed school. I would guess that it had about 40 or 50% white and 40-50% African American, a smattering of... There wasn't a large Latino population at that time, but of other so-called races. Mm-hmm. It was a good school, a decent school. There was not a lot of consciousness of colleges and so forth, but the expectation there was that they used to have a track system, an honors track, a college preparatory track, a commercial track, and a shop track. And that led to a lot of segregation within the school because right. the honors and college track were more light-skinned. Mm-hmm. And the commercial and shop and so forth were more people of color. But still, we had lots of classes in common. It was just that certain courses would be more heavily subscribed by people of one background or another. And I was in the college preparatory mm-hmm. track. I was not an honors student. The home environment was not one where there's a lot of high pressure to do. My parents expected I would do something besides dig ditches, but it wasn't very prescriptive. And the demands were, you know, you go to school and do your work there, and then you come home and we feed you and you are a dutiful son. It was a lot more law and order back then. There was a lot less concern about self-esteem and more concern about obedience.
Right.
Doing what you're told.
Yes.
No lip.
What kind of things were you involved in school?
I did play the flute and picked it up since I retired quite seriously. So my father was a flutist in the Marine Band. He was a Marine in World War I. So he was older than many of my peers' parents. And he played the flute pretty good. He was in the regimental band, was stationed in Cuba to guard the sugarcane from the Germans. And, of course, back then, Cuba had recently been taken from Spain. My family was very religious in the sense of a kind of fundamentalist background. And I went along with that until probably my high school years when I began to connect dots and not come up with the same narrative that my parents did about the importance. I was a Boy Scout. I was an Eagle Scout. So you can see there was this kind of orthodoxy there. Yes. But I began to chafe and rebel against that in my own mind a lot earlier than when I started to take some action about it. But certainly high school was a period in which I do remember becoming skeptical about mm-hmm. organized religious dogma. I don't know whether that addresses your question, but it's certainly something that stands out as part of the shaping or lack of shaping of my family background upon me.
Yes, understood. What was your favorite subject in school? What did you like to study? Were you thinking that way at the time?
I did not have that mature a sense of some courses were good and some mm-hmm. courses weren't, but it was, as I recall, mostly a function of whether I liked the teacher.
Yes.
the teaching quality varied a lot, and I remember liking courses in math or literature or civics or geography, or not liking them, mm-hmm. depending mostly on the teacher. I think that I didn't really develop the school subjects were taught rather. History was, you know, dates, kings, queens, mm-hmm. wars, a lot of rote memorization of big events that were in newspapers. English was a subject that I did okay in. Reading I liked or didn't like depending on the books. you know, something like The Vicar of Wakefield, for example, did not give me goosebumps. But I liked, you know, the American fiction in particular, Jack London, Hemingway. I was also drawn to sort of Mickey Mouse science. It was called science, but it was really just fooling around with springs and levers. And I became kind of handy and liked doing experiments in the labs. I don't think I was thinking any deep thoughts. I wasn't worried about quantum theory or relativity at all. But I liked lab sciences because you got to mess around. So as with most kids in that age, we were constantly fiddling with chemistry to try to build bombs. I did build a cannon. Which,
wow.
Yeah, out of an old pipe and using some ball bearings. This was a kid. We were boys. Mm-hmm. And the sort of hands-on gee whiz wow part of science was an interest to me. I don't think I really excelled or got interested in subject matter till college.
Got you.
Which was very important. And we'll go, you can go into that later
yes.
if you want.
Absolutely. In 1 minute, I would like to go back and talk about your father a bit. You mm-hmm. said he was a Marine in World War I.
Mm-hmm.
How did that? Do you think that shaped your family dynamic, and how did that shape it?
I'm sure it did. You're asking much tougher questions because the questions you ask force me to come up with, or suggest I should come up with answers, and I don't want to invent answers that simply seem satisfactory for
right.
the occasion. My father came from an authoritarian family, a Presbyterian. His grandfather fought in the Civil War. His father was a telegrapher on the Pennsylvania Railroad, very much, you know, worked 29 days a month. That was back in the old days of the Pennsylvania Railroad. Mm-hmm. And his mother was a high school graduate, a very strong woman who did participate in the feminist movement in northwestern Pennsylvania.
Oh, wow.
And my father's sister, looked quite a bit younger than he, did become quite a forceful and eager participant in the women's suffrage movement to get the vote. This would have been back before World War I. But the idea of obedience, family structure, authority, right and wrong were kind of hard and fast principles, and children were to be molded to succeed in the roles that were pretty well set out. So it was more of a 19th century kind of family, as you
gotcha.
Know from fiction. So I would say the Marines was not inconsistent, but whether it changed my father, I don't know. But that's certainly in keeping with what he would have done.
Got you. Okay, so College. Where did you go to college?
I went to college at George Washington University, which is a private university, but with a strong presence in Washington, D.C. as a place where a number of public school students sought to go. And I did, on a scholarship. And it was in college where the kind of teaching and the kind of approach to the subject matter was so different from high school. Anything. It was such a rupture intellectually. I'm sure that looking back on it, the teaching was okay, but I just loved. I mean, from the first lectures, I would sit and listen to people who would speak sort of like the preachers in the church, but they had many different kinds of things to say from, you know, hellfire and damnation. And so I just began to develop this voracious appetite based on early courses that I took in all fields, but particularly in the social sciences, psychology, anthropology, sociology. I just loved that stuff because it seemed to offer a rational account of human beings individually and socially. And I just dove in and loved it.
And you liked asking questions?
Pardon?
You liked asking questions?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And hearing people who had so much to say, in answering them, they brought such a different experience from the high school teachers, for instance, who were pretty much part of the fairly scruffy working class background that I was from. And these people had been places, done things, and had personal backgrounds that just made me think, my gosh. So I became, as a first year student, I remember just saying, oh, I want to do this, I want to do that. In the social sciences, mostly. I don't want to get into anecdotes, but sometimes an anecdote can be illustrative. I remember in a course that I took, I'm pretty sure it was in my first year, in, I believe, sociology, there was this fellow who worked for the National Training School for Boys, which was an institution dealing with juvenile delinquency. And I thought, what an interesting way to think about crime, deviance, and so forth. Instead of just sort of saying, well, lock up the criminals, there was this attempt to explain what I had grown up seeing. I didn't participate in any gang activities, but crime was all over the place, and here were people offering accounts of why people became criminals. And I thought, well, that's a neat kind of topic. And so this one guy who was a sort of a dapper fellow, I remember wore suits and diamond, I thought looked like a mobster, lots of jewelry. And he took me under his wing and took me to the this old Bastille structure in Baltimore, the Maryland state lockup. And here I am, an 18 or 19 year old being shown, and he'd say, he'd introduce me to the warden and say, Alverson here is thinking about penology and criminology. Of course, I went on to many other subjects, but there were professors who actually took you places, and holy smokes. I also had a job. I had worked 20 hours a week throughout college, so it was my life was pretty heavily programmed. I wouldn't say I had fun in college in any sense that Dartmouth would be, say, a provisioner or provider of fun. 20 hours a week and taking 5 courses a term keeps you off the streets.
Yes, it does.
I worked at the Library of Congress and to pay for a big part. And it was at the end of the first year that I left home, because of the ferment in my mind and conflict between me and my parents over things like civil rights, which was very much cranking up, had already, but I was exposed to it in a very different way at college. This would be 1960, 61, than I was in the neighborhood and in high school.
Right. Can you really quickly, what year did you enter college?
1960.
Okay. And how did, think of how to word this. Did you see your relationship with your parents? You said you saw it change when you entered college.
Well, certainly, yeah. It gave me a lot of capacity for reasoning and ways of thinking that changed it, yes. I think the underlying dynamic, which was rather rebellious and skeptical, became better informed. Mm-hmm. It wasn't just, I don't want to do this. There were reasons. And I got involved in sort of early civil rights activities with not so much at GW, where I went to school, but at the Library of Congress, where we had a lot of students from Howard University, which is the big African-American school, minor state teachers college, then now called District of Columbia University.
Did your parents... Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Oh. There was... This is not that important, actually, but the GW, they had a group of students who were participating in a lot of desegregation activity in Maryland on Route 40, which was still segregated at that time. And the Washington Star, which is a conservative paper, began to write articles about this communist cell at GW, which is back then the word you used for any kind of behavior that seemed to threaten the establishment.
Right.
My father figured out, I'm not sure how, that I was sort of being swept up in this stuff. And he would have these tantrums, yelling and bellowing and raging, and about my ruining my life if I got associated with these people who went out and had the state police drag them away from lunch counters. And so it was in part that, I'm skipping ahead maybe some months, but it was that kind of thing that made me think, I can't stick around. And I left and got my own apartment right near GW at Washington Circle. Now it's so genteel. I paid with a roommate, I paid $60 a month, 30 each.
Wow.
To live in an apartment. That was a total cold water flat. But now an apartment in that building would cost $5,000. So you can see times have changed.
Did your parents' reaction have... Did it make you think twice about anything you were doing, or did it sort
no,
of...
No, for instance, they sent around the minister from my mother's and father's church. He tried to call. I didn't want to talk to him, but he went calling to tell me about, you know, how I have to... I'm leading to this breakdown of the family as well as repudiating God, blah, blah, blah. And indeed I was, and I became more and more convinced of the... at least more and more confident that I'd... done what was difficult because I was on my own,
right?
But was important to do.
And then I understand you went to Yale for grad school?
I went from GW right to Yale, yes. I was supposed to go into the Navy, but I met the person who is still my wife, who said, you're crazy. And so that, I hadn't put two and two together. I was enrolling in the Reserve Officer Corps, which is sort of a Navy officer program, because working class people, I had a draft card, and I was A1, which meant I was perfectly eligible
right.
to be drafted, except there were deferments in the sense that if you were in college or married or had kids, there were these, it was a poverty lottery, basically,
right.
back then. Anyway, but because of my eyesight, that fizzled out. And then I met Marianne in my third year, and she said, no, you can do better than that. You should go to... Because I was very much interested in my subject matter of study, anthropology and linguistics by that time. And she said, you should go to graduate school. Graduate school? That sounds like a royal road to unemployment. And I didn't, although I suppose I could easily have done okay as in a profession... it seemed like the life of the mind back then. The post-Sputnik money was flowing like crazy. What was it, 57, that the Russians sent up the first rat or dog? And money flowed into colleges mm-hmm. and graduate schools, national defense loans and grants. And so it worked out that I got a... I had actually a scholarship to Yale and then got an NSF or an NIH grant to continue studying at Yale for 4 years, and I finished in four.
Got you. You said your wife's name was Marianne?
Marianne, spelled as in the French or German way, Marianne.
And what was her last name?
Her maiden name was Melchior. She was German.
Can you spell that?
Melchior, like the biblical king.
Oh.
One of those guys.
Yes. Yes.
She was actually born in China. Her parents were German, but they lived in China. They were not part of World War. Her immediate family were not part of World War II.
Got you. And how did you two meet?
At college at GW, in the same class. We didn't. Also at the Library of Congress, because at that time GW didn't have a very extensive library. So a lot of college students would just come into the central reading room, where by that time I had been moved up to be sort of fixture at the central desk. So I would see lots of young people from all over the city who were studying there. That no longer happens. You've got to have a pass.
Yeah.
It's very hard to get in.
Yes.
Anyway, so we met at college and at the library.
And she talked you into grad school.
Yes, I would say, well, she certainly turned my thinking that way. Yes.
Got you. Why Yale?
Back then, a big variable was how much financial aid. I didn't have any money. My parents were not poor, but they certainly didn't have any money. My father worked as a repo man for a furniture store in Washington, D.C., and this is skipping ahead. He was quite old, and he worked for this small furniture store, which was burned down when the city burned in 1967. Well, this is skipping ahead, but they didn't have money, so I had to pretty much pay for my way, and so it was important to get, and Yale offered a very good financial package. And I also taught at a small state school in New Haven. You weren't supposed to, but I did, because we had a kid that came along unexpected in my second year.
Right.
So that keeps you serious.
That does. Were there other grad schools that you had applied to?
Yes, quite a few, and I got into all of them, but the financial packages were different, and I was focused on the money, and
right.
I got into very good, as I say, this is post-Sputnik munificence, so I got into Michigan, University of Washington, Berkeley, Harvard, Columbia, Stanford, I think. I mean, that shows you the, because this isn't really a compliment to me, it was a comment on the Times. They wanted, if you had a pulse, they wanted you to study so that you could be useful to the national defense.
Right, right. So you had options.
Yes, very much so.
But Yale was your best financial choice.
Was the best financial choice, and a lot of, two of my favorite teachers at GW were from Yale, so they talked it up and wrote letters.
Sure. And that helps.
That helps, yes, for sure.
Can you talk about Yale's campus a little bit, the general social situation?
Well, as in undergraduate school, I was very busy in my own little world, so I wasn't paying too much attention. New Haven was pretty much what it has. It was in one of the down phases of a pretty rough decline because of the moving out of manufacturing jobs. So New Haven was a very poor, we would call it a crime-ridden city, and Yale was this island of opulence. And the interactions between the campus, the university, and the town were quite fractious. So it didn't affect me so much because I really did throw myself into my studies. I was in my third year there, I was preparing to go away to do field work in Africa. So I wasn't as cognizant of the campus life. Oh, I loved it. I went to all the colloquia and seminars and, the presentation of, this kind of sort of neo-Gothic architecture, stones and lots of mahogany. I think Yale was also in a bit of a financial hard patch, but it still looked pretty spiffy.
Yes.
And glitzy to me. And I enjoyed my courses, immensely, and arguing and picking fights with, over issues of the day in the field. And that kept me going for 2 years, taking comprehensive exams. Back then you had to do well in several different tracks in anthropology, biological, archaeology, linguistics, as well as cultural. And then in my third year, I went to Africa for a year for field work. So that sort of took me away. But it was in that year of 67, that so many of the American cities 65 in Watts' case, but in 67, several inner cities, including Washington, D.C., were burned by the riots that,
yes,
like the sort of thing we've been hearing about in Baltimore and St. Louis, except much bigger. And the cities went through they plummeted. I mean, the core of the areas of cities were hollowed out. And D.C. became a wasteland in many ways, except for the most genteel suburbs and so forth. But I was in Africa at that time, and I was in South Africa, actually, working in the mines, a problem or issue that needn't bother us here. But in any case, people would say, well, why do you want to go back to the States? It's burning. Of course, South Africa was a tinderbox, but not acknowledged to be such at the time. Although Nelson Mandela was arrested, I believe, in 1966, if I'm not mistaken. I'm not certain about that. But that was the era. So things were very much, the cauldron was boiling, but it seemed very orderly because of the oppressive state. So I did come back in late 67, and then spent 68 writing my thesis. And then that was the time that I really began to re-engage with the civil rights movement, with the labor movement at Yale, with the anti-war movement, which had been building. I had been a bit involved in the Vietnam anti-war movement in college, but that sort of got put on the back burner when I was in grad school. But then it revived in 68, and that's when I came to Dartmouth. And so I was bringing a lot of baggage.
Yes. So just to go over some context, you got to Yale in 1964?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And I do want to backtrack a minute and ask, do you remember where you were when Kennedy was assassinated?
I do. That was 1963. Yes. I was in undergraduate school, and I was standing in the college bookstore with Marianne when the news came over that he'd been shot.
Wow.
So as you are surmising, you have these kind of... they're not always accurate, but I think mine is, in this case, a kind of flashbulb memory of the place. And I'm pretty sure I was standing in the bookstore and the radio was on. We were buying some books. That was way before the internet. And the news came on, and we were just absolutely stunned. And then shortly before that, also, I was at GW, I think it was the year, the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Yes. Yes.
Which was, I believe, 62 or earlier
62.
In 62. And I remember students in classes bringing little transistor radios because here we are in Washington, D.C. If there's going to be an atomic war, we're going to be right in the middle of it.
Right,
so
right.
So it wasn't like Minnesota or Tennessee, so we were really anxious.
Was there any sort of uproar on campus at that point?
The uproar over not that I remember. There was a student group which I was associated with, SDS, Students for Democratic Society, associated with the free speech movement at Berkeley, which I think was 2 or 3 years earlier than that, 59, 60. But the anti-war activity was certainly, in my experience of it, having its earliest manifestations around Kennedy's decision to send advisors to Vietnam, and then picked up a lot with Johnson's acceleration. But by that time, I was in New Haven, so there was some anti-war, standing around handing out leaflets, but it was kind of subdued. Who are these people? The civil rights, Martin Luther King would have been assassinated, in April of 68? So but the 4 years prior to that was a kind of crescendo, and I was involved in that, but decreasingly so because I was more oriented toward getting into graduate school at that time, and I was absorbed with research I was doing at GW. So I was a little less engaged in my third and fourth year. I also got married after college.
So we have this buildup. And then 1968, you got here to Dartmouth.
In July, right.
July.
July or August of 68.
So, going over some things.
Are we sort of on track in terms of the information that you were hoping what might be there?
Yes, yes. So 68 was a big year.
Yes, it was. It was a very big year.
That was the start of the Tet Offensive, I believe. And
yes, there was a lot. The war was going badly.
Yes.
By 68, and I was newly an assistant professor here, and my students were, I was very much carrying on from Yale, where I, when you're writing your dissertation, you have more time to make mm-hmm. trouble. And so I was very involved with the anti-war movement at Yale. I did not burn my draft card. I was about to. William Sloan Coffin, the name may ring a bell. He was the chaplain of Yale University. He actually just died recently. He retired at South Stratford here in Vermont. And he was down there at Beinecke Library, and we were all going to throw our draft cards in the hopper. And fortunately, I thought, I had been offered a job at McGill. Mm-hmm. So the plan was, if they draft me, I'll just go to McGill. I had that in my pocket, but also the job at Dartmouth.
Right.
And I couldn't obviously go both, but if I felt ready. But my son, Keith, who turns, I would believe, 50 this year, was a three-year-old mm-hmm. in 68. He was born in 65. And so Marianne came down with Keith and started screaming, "You can't burn your draft card. You've got a family to support." So I didn't. But there I was. Anyway, I came, you can see it was a pretty full head of steam.
Yes.
Coming to Dartmouth.
Yes, absolutely. I was going to ask something, and it's totally left my head. I was wondering, what was your thesis about?
My thesis at Yale,
at
doctoral
Yale.
Thesis,
yes, at Yale.
Yes. Well, let me give you the sprightly title. It was called The Social and Organizational Antecedents of Job Satisfaction Among Black South African Industrial Workers. And
wow.
It was a rather quantitative study of mm-hmm. what sorts of characteristics of people who were basically from either rural areas of South Africa or adjacent countries, or who were from the townships around cities, what led them to want to continue working as a career as opposed to just remaining a migrant and going back and forth between a rural area where farming was common and going to jobs as the need for money required it. So it was a study of the transition from being farmers to being industrial workers. Even though the work conditions were horrific,
right.
This was the cash economy.
Mm-hmm.
And the thesis, you know, was okay. I did published a little of it here and there in articles, but it was really later when I went back to the rural areas to study the other half. I worked in the industries that had migrant labor, glass factories, chemical plants, gold mines, and so forth,
wow.
with the African workers,
mm-hmm.
But the home life back in the farm was something that I simply heard stories about, and
right.
so I realized in early 70s that I had to go back at least to some sample of rural areas to see what's the impact on their absence, on the arrival of cash, and it was all one piece of research. It wasn't just the thesis. I sort of continued that, and I wrote a book in 78, which did very well, summarizing mm-hmm. the research that I've done over about 4 or 5 years on that topic.
Gotcha. So did that track of research have anything to do with your relationship with Dartmouth at that point and your job offer?
I think that Dartmouth and some other schools were intrigued by the fact that I was, at that time, an anthropologist weren't known for working in factories or in cities. They were,
right.
It was the stereotype of the under the banana tree on the small
right.
island, Margaret Mead.
Mm-hmm.
And that I was working at this borderland with other social sciences, working on rapid change that was associated with the breakdown of geographic centers or focus of cultures.
Mm-hmm.
That cultures were being created across huge distances and movement of people, and that was kind of novel.
Yes.
And yes. The work I did was pretty happily and well recognized as kind of path breaking for that time. It's since become quite ordinary, but anyway.
Ordinary, well.
Yeah, or at least more common for in the anthro department today. For the cultural anthropologists work in medicine, in hospitals, in conservation movements. You know, it's obviously the isolated rural tribe, which never was a reality. Certainly has ceased to even have the appearance of that. People don't live in little isolated villages much, at least as a full part of their life. Mm-hmm. There's constant movement in and out.
Got you. So you get to campus in 1968. What was Hanover like then?
It was amazing. I mean, I after Washington, D.C. and New Haven, which were both pretty scruffy, I had lived in a sort of an experiment in New Haven, which was an integrated housing project, which had all kinds of crime. It was a kind of almost seems like utopian attempt to build housing in the inner city, and what it was populated with were working class African Americans and graduate students. Well, that's not the ideal composition for a neighborhood because the graduate students come and go.
Right.
And it was built in a slum, a real ghetto where crime was rampant, and so there was constant burglary. We've had burglars in our place stealing their laundry. It was pretty mean streets. And so after that, coming here, holy smokes, this is like this is a silk cocoon. Even though back then it was nothing like it is now. There was only one stoplight in Hanover, and the roads were not trafficked, and Hanover was this little island of and Lebanon was a declining working class community. Lyme was a farming community. Hanover was a fraction of its size. But from the point of view of just not locking your doors and the kids run out and go anywhere and so forth, it was just wonderful. So from that point of view, it was a great... I can give you an anecdote if you want.
Yes,
we're going to run out of time if I do too many anecdotes. So I had a pistol in New Haven because of security, and we had a burglar in the house. And I didn't shoot anybody, but I took this gun to the police station in East Haven, Connecticut, and I said, I want to turn this thing in because I'm going to a place where we don't need this for security. And there was a program in Connecticut at the time to turn in your handgun. Well, that you know where that went. So the guy said, are you crazy? You got to keep this. And I said, no, I don't need it. So I gave it to him, and he turns around and says, hey, does anybody want a pistol? This is the policeman.
Oh, my gosh.
So... But I was glad to be rid of it. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of a story that makes you realize that I knew where I was coming because I'd visited a couple of times. And knew
where
it was. And so Keith, the older one, would have been about 3, and the younger one was not born for 2 more years. But it was a great place.
Yes.
But it was also a place where the anti-war movement and to some extent the civil rights movement, because of Martin Luther King's assassination in 68, there was a sort of a wedding of those two. And then only a couple or 3 years later, the women's movement with the coeducation, which I was very much involved. And these were coming almost like a maelstrom, almost like a, you know, the world is falling. I read the little essay aspect I wrote there, that the world seemed to be falling apart, and I was certainly not helping, except to make it fall apart. And so I and some other faculty, not too many, were known as sort of the agitators and coaches of the anti-war movement and the civil rights movement and then the move for coeducation. And I was very much too busy for my own good in that, but... I also wasn't a deadbeat in terms of study, so even though they wished like hell I would get out of here, I stayed.
Do you remember at all campus reaction to, you know, the beginning of the Tet Offensive or MLK's assassination, Bobby Kennedy's assassination?
Well, Bobby, the Kennedy assassination MLK assassination took place before I was really here. That was in April.
Oh, yes.
And so I didn't get here till August. So that political turmoil was somewhat behind, but there was still a lot of invocation of those events as significant episodes in what students deemed to be the course of change. Mm-hmm. Also happening at the same time, although I wasn't so much associated with it immediately, but there were a lot of students who were beginning to despair of this and were seeking this sort of back to the land, which had been a current in American thinking for some time, but the hippies, mm-hmm, and the counterculture.
Yes.
Woodstock, I forget when that was, but it was, I think,
69.
And that's the whole thing. It's hard to tease apart. And I wasn't a booster, but I was certainly very eager to let students talk about it. And they saw me as, I mean, another anecdote to take time. When the students who were in Parkhurst in May of 69 were, yes, arrested, several of them were in my course on culture change. And they had to go to the lockup,
right,
at Grafton for 30 days. Some were sent to other places. And so a couple or three times at least, I packed all the subject matter and books in the van and went up there and held a class right on the prison grounds for the students so they could keep up with the coursework. Well, that, today, that would sound very exotic. But it seemed back then to be just sort of... I was also very interested in things like admissions and... Mm-hmm. The curriculum and what was going on at Dartmouth that could better prepare students to address,
right,
those national movements and so forth.
Right. So, yes, so Parkhurst, I believe, was spring of 1969?
Yeah.
So that was your first spring on campus?
It was my first spring on campus, but there had been a lot of teach-ins. There, mm-hmm, were, I don't believe the Collis Center yet existed, but there were student-organized courses that addressed civil rights, that addressed the war. And I think that in 68, 69, and 70, the war became the biggest piece of the student activism because of the... Well, there wasn't a big city, for instance, with a civil, right, rights movement in it. But there were... ROTC was, mm-hmm, on campus. The ideology of the times among the anti-war movement was that universities were complicit, right, in providing intellectual and physical resources for a horrific and stupid war. And that certainly got a lot of attention. There were lots of faculty meetings about keeping ROTC or not.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, looking back on it, the attempt to blame ROTC was more—it was more a target of convenience than it was a rational attack on the strategy.
Mm-hmm.
But the disruption—lots of students would rent buses and go to DC for the marches.
Yes.
The general disturbance of the streets, of which many Dartmouth students were part, I think was probably the most potent theater connected with the anti-war movement, rather than throwing poor John Dickey out of his office in Parkhurst.
So you were a relatively young professor.
Yes.
Did you feel that you were sort of caught between the positions of the administration and the students?
Well, to some extent, yes. So, for instance, there were several meetings in... I mean, I'll give you an anecdotal answer. There were several meetings, this was before and independent of the student takeover of Parkhurst, of which I was not a part, but there were meetings in Parkhurst Hall in the stairwell. So when you go up those stairs, there'd be,
yes,
meetings on the staircase, there'd be meetings in the stairwell, and I was often there and asked to speak and talk about it. I had no particular academic background that would have made me better, but I didn't mind speaking, and I had been involved for a while. And Leonard Reeser, who was the dean of the faculty at the time, was there once, and I gave a talk, and the student, and Reeser turned to me and said, "Hoyt, I'm holding you responsible for everything that goes on in this building." So in that's in answering your question, yes. I mean, but I suspect that at that time, I was not sympathetic to the problems of being a dean or an administrator. Mm-hmm. I did definitely see them as stuck on the wrong side of history, and that they were, I didn't see them as the enemy, but they were definitely, how should I say, unsympathetic to the rough and tumble of protest, which has got to take place somewhere.
Right.
Well, students aren't going to go down to the parking lot in West Lebanon to hold demonstrations. They're going to do it here. So for administrators, it was like you're giving our university a black eye. You know, they were preoccupied with law, order, and PR, which is their job. So in that sense, I was not too concerned about their PR problems at all, and that this was using a local resource as a fulcrum for increasing one's leverage to change a national policy, and students do that. And I don't think this was particularly disruptive at Dartmouth, say, compared to the University of Wisconsin, Berkeley, Columbia, maybe even Harvard or Yale. I didn't know what was going on there. But that's what happens when young people get incensed. They start making noises, and the college is trying to tamp it down. Although they, you know, there was, you know, I wouldn't say that they did anything that was illegal to repress it, but they just weren't seen as part of the solution.
Got you. So you really went from a city in the middle of the situation to still a city, but slightly removed, to the middle of nowhere.
Right. Yeah, you could see.
But you were also seeing time progress.
Yes.
And the movement progress across those years.
Right.
So I'm trying to think how to phrase this.
Well, the waters from the centers were lapping up on in the boundaries and the edges of the periphery. Even small campuses like Colby Sawyer or Hobart Williams or some of the, you know, smaller schools were equally embroiled.
Yes.
And campuses were, because of the draft, let's not get too idealistic.
Right.
I know from the Iraq War, there was not a lot of student interest in the Iraq, the stupidity of that, which I was equally horrified at. The idea, the invasion of Iraq was one of the dumbest. It didn't have the scale of the Vietnam War, but the ignorance was every bit as great. And the enthusiasms were equally hubristic and misguiding, at least, if not criminal. I just think that this, but at that time the campus was, you know, there were a few. I stood out on the corner of Wheelock and Main and with signs with 40 or 50 other people. Well, it would have been 400 or 500 in the Vietnam War, and the difference, I think, was the lack of a draft. So if you want to fight wars and not stir up the pot too much, don't have a volunteer army. And the powers that be saw that pretty clearly.
Did you see sort of a change in campus tension when the draft lottery was reinstated? I believe that was December of 1969.
I can't relate what I saw to that specific event.
Gotcha.
I suspect that's the case, but I don't have any memory or evidence that that was focal. It certainly split the campus in the sense that there were a number of students who graduated and went into the service. And then there was this anti-war, anti-Razi movement here. And I suspect the lottery was fed into that in some way, but I don't have evidence as to how exactly.
Right. Okay. So at this point, were you still in touch with your parents?
Yes. In a distant way, around mainly the issues of they want to see the grandchildren.
Right.
So we would visit for short visits, and I remember having lots of almost funny encounters when we'd go down there. This was in the early 70s, late 60s. My father would rant and rail about the city being driven to a stop by the anti-war demonstrations, and they haven't got the brains God sent, meant for geese. And one or two of them, I had been in those demonstrations and just came over to the house, and he was talking about me, obviously, but I didn't tell him. So part of the just modus vivendi was, we didn't talk, I didn't say anything about what I was involved in at Dartmouth. They thought, well, he's got a job in an Ivy League school, I guess that's good. And they have the grandchildren, blah, blah, blah. So it became parallel lives.
Got you. Got you. Okay, let's see. So the Kent State shooting also, that was...
That was huge.
That was huge?
Yeah, really huge. What, mine was a 70?
I believe 70, yes.
1970, yes. That, again, that there was ongoing... Kent State, the Cambodia bombing, then a little later, Watergate and Nixon, those were adding to the crescendo of activity that began, because I left for Africa at the very beginning of 1973 and it was away for 2 years, I lost a lot of touch with how Dartmouth dealt with Nixon's temporizing and the bullshit from Kissinger and the peace, Paris peace talks, because I wasn't here. I was in Botswana in Africa. Wow. So I was living in a mud hut. And so that has its own challenges. And you don't... I listen to the BBC and gleefully hear reports about Nixon. But I sort of don't have data from 73 till I came back again in late 75. So it's not that nothing was happening. I just don't know what it was.
Right.
There was no internet. You know, you got
you
got aerograms.
Wow.
So it was very different, quite isolating. Yes. Well, I mean, it's a great piece of field work. I loved it, but it's very absorbing when you're living in a tiny agricultural community in the middle of Central Africa. You just don't stay plugged in the way you do if you were in a big city.
So did you see, with the change in, I believe, administration after Parkhurst, I believe there was sort of a...
Kemeny became president, yes. He became president in 1970, I believe, and he was smart enough to sort of get in the front of the train regarding the war. So he had, for instance, McGovern, the anti-war peace candidate, was here several times, and Kemeny was positioned himself very differently from the way Dickey did, who was sort of this old guard State Department type, and Kemeny was a young, new mathematician. The thing that became, I think, Kemeny's big problem was coeducation, which was not really direct, but it was certainly indirectly fueled by the general sense of ferment and change that the Vietnam War created. So in some ways the move for coeducation benefited from the enthusiasms and the mobilization processes that were afoot. But that was where Kemeny and I parted ways. there was a long history, and I think a bad history, of how coeducation came to Dartmouth. It's portrayed officially as a top-down set of decisions that were made by people. That's bullshit. Total bullshit.
Talk about it a little more. I would love to.
Is that rain? I'm going to have to... Yeah, I'm on a bicycle, but I'll call my wife. Well, that's a shift of subject, the coeducation. Are we finished with the war? And
I mean, if you would like to talk a little more about sort of campus climate or...
It was a regular feature of... My classes weren't... I didn't let them become political arenas. I was pretty businesslike about classes, but after classes or in student seminars and in the campus activities, the anti-war, anti-Razi activity were constant, were leitmotifs or themes that cropped up here and there.
Gotcha.
The coeducation one was coming on at the same time, and I think inspired by a lot of the move for civil rights and the student empowerment buzzword back then. And I was very much involved, along with a lot more faculty, regarding the desirability of coeducation. And that's where Kemeny was caught between the curmudgeons with the money and the campus, which seemed, from the point of view of faculty and students, to be strongly leaning toward wanting coeducation. And there were lots of debates about, well, could Dartmouth afford it? What about the reduction in the number of male matriculants? Would the alumni stop writing the checks? And there were lots of very bombastic statements about how coeducation could doom this place. In the end, Kemeny got in front of that, but he was also dragging his feet. He made some very silly proposals about establishing an associated school for women that is not publicized much. It's such a harebrained idea to have subjects that women were interested in. And, oh, it was always pathetic. But that was a case where the president was caught between his conservative and probably well-to-do alumni and people with access to the megaphone and the money, putting pressure on him, and finally he capitulated. But there was a minor scandal in this, not made public that I know of, that full sex-blind or sex-blind admissions didn't occur until about 1979 or 80.
Oh, wow.
So there was a 6, 7, or 8 year period where women were screened to produce a complementary group that would appreciate the men at Dartmouth and not ruffle their feathers. And Kemeny was very much part of the need, what he felt was the need to regulate the spigot, the kind of, and a number of women admitted. And it wasn't until 79, and then he, I think, was succeeded by McLaughlin in 80. I believe that's right, but I'm not certain. And by that time, the trustees voted, with him dissenting, to have sex-blind admission.
Wow.
That's not a piece of the public record that's well-known. It's part of the public record because I have it.
Right.
But it's not something that Dartmouth
publicizes,
right. That there was this period, and that, boy, was hard on women. It was really hard on women. I know a number of female students who were students of mine or I knew well who said it was a rough row. There was a lot of, as you might imagine, it's like sexually integrating a fire department.
Right.
There's going to be a lot of raspberry and making it hard. Yes. That, I think, is now past, but it certainly wasn't made easier by these stalling and moderating influences
right.
that Kemeny was pretty much tied to.
So I know that 1968 to 69, I believe, was the first year they had, I think, 7 women on campus as sort of an experiment. Did you?
Not 7 women, it was 7 colleges. There were certain schools who would allow women to come to Dartmouth for a year and do a transfer year. Wellesley, Smith, Holyoke, Amherst, and some others. Now, when you said 7 students, I was...
I believe 1968 to 1969, the school did sort of an experiment where they had 7 women join the drama department for a year, and they were not allowed to stay and get Dartmouth diplomas. They were asked to leave after the 1 year.
I can't... That's the first I've heard that particular formulation. There were a lot more women than that in classes, because they were in my classes, but they were called exchange students.
Okay.
And they were women. Mm-hmm. So I think we might be on different topics here. The drama department may, in fact, Meryl Streep was one of them.
Yes.
That may have been specific to the drama department. I don't know. But there were certainly many more than 7 women. They weren't huge numbers, but they were...
Well, 1968. This is 68?
I'm talking about... 60, Well, I don't know about 68 because I came right. in 68, but certainly from 69 on, mm-hmm. my recollection was that there were female students, not numerous, in many departments.
Got you.
But I can't speak about the drama department.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So that was a big change on campus,
yes.
clearly.
Mm-hmm.
You said, from your point of view, there was general student support for that?
Yes. I think that if you go back and look at the D mm-hmm. Or any other sort of public media record, you'll see that the students seemed, by 69, 70, to be really, particularly 70, 71, 72, there was quite a growth of student support for coeducation.
Got you. Did you see sort of a transfer of energy, I guess, from, you know, Vietnam protesting to coeducation
yes.
movement?
Or yeah, I'm not sure the physics is that exact, but the certainly the spirit of the times mm-hmm. Seemed, I think, conducive to tapping into those energies and the sort of the irreverence, the belief that the administration were, you know, old farts and were not about to be leaders in this,
right.
that they were dragging their feet. I think the stereotypes from the anti-war movement transferred over into the women's movement, and which was very much tied up with
right.
co-education.
Right. So you said then 73 you left campus and went back to Africa?
I did. Very actually late 72 to do 2 years of field work on the topic that my dissertation was on, but
right.
to put it in a bigger context.
You want to talk a little bit about that more?
Can do. The issue that I realized from my first stint of work in South African mines and industries was that the rural area was really the biggest piece of the picture as to
mm-hmm.
why of the phenomenon of labor migration and culture and psychological change among African populations that were caught up in this vortex of industrialization. South Africa, as you might know from your classes, recruited mine labor and migrant labor from not just South Africa, but many of the surrounding countries. And very few areas of Southern Africa, almost as big as the United States, were not left alone in that. So young men in particular, but increasingly women in terms of domestic service and other reasons, part of their rural life, an intimate part, was leaving and working for
mm-hmm.
wages, often to supplement food production or to buy what we'd call capital equipment for farming or to pay school fees or to whatever. So the world of industrial, factory, formal employment, and the world of semi-subsistent, because it wasn't fully adequate ever, agriculture and rural life were intimately being connected.
Mm-hmm.
And what my research showed, and that I hypothesized pretty early, was that what used to be thought of as contraries, traditional, modern,
mm-hmm.
and there were a lot of the word back then was modernization studies.
Yes.
What makes people? I thought, boy, that's a real simplification, because in a sense, neither the nature of formal wage labor nor the nature of rural areas was staying constant while they got knitted together by this movement of people. Everything was changing. And it was a systemic change that required a whole different way of looking at human society,
mm-hmm.
where you have these entrepôts of formal employment, wage labor, institutions of control that are part of Western society, and their insertion into rural areas, which were being changed by that process, often by the migrants themselves, who suddenly are bringing money, who have ideas about individuality and their personhood, because of being both involved intimately in wage labor and being involved as often kinfolk in a smaller scale rural community, which
right.
is nothing like what it was 150 years earlier. So that was the topic, and I wrote a book called Mind in the Heart of Darkness, which played a bit on the title of Conrad's book,
played quite a lot of, which was to show that the meaning of the title, the irony there is that the Heart of Darkness is not the Congo and the African world, it was the world of the colonial structuration of those societies. That was the Heart of Darkness, was the colonial system, not, you know, the savages running around with skulls on sticks.
Right.
And so I was making an acerbic kind of comment on what where the darkness lay, and that the adaptations were as much to this whole colonial regime as it was to physical environments or just individual survival. Mind being the metaphor for the ability, the tenacity, the resilience, adaptability of the people to live in this whole new world.
Yes.
So that's as fast as I can summarize a lot.
Did you feel that your sort of absences from the mindset of the United States at this point and your own research, did that have any effect on how you viewed the anti-war movement and the civil rights movement and the way that it was being conducted?
Yes, I did. Now, you're asking a much more complicated question than it appears, and I'm sure on reflection I'll have gazillions of thoughts, but to try to sort of just on off the cuff say, well, how does the fact, for instance, my conceptions of skin color had to have been profoundly. We lived in a little village where the only white people, and Brian, my younger son, I remember it was an anecdote that Marianne wrote in one of her memoirs, that he came up and said, "Mom, why are we this funny yellow color?" Well, that's not, you know, that's a kind of eye-opener.
Right.
Like what's normal and what's different. So skin color definitely was not in my awareness after this kind of experience as a significant marker, because I had to move in between and did so pretty successfully. Also, the concept of race, which is trays on a sort of pseudo-biological mythology, sort of pseudoscience biology.
Yes.
Races do not exist in human species. They do among dogs and corn, but not among Homo sapiens. We are a very homogenous species.
Mm-hmm.
But skin color as a social marker is huge.
Right.
Obviously, it's as a signifier, you don't get much bigger than that. So one of my puzzlements is how could, in this day and age, something that's that irrelevant in terms of our species existence be such an important segmentation of people. Melanin is an adaptation to ultraviolet radiation, and it's sort of like adaptation to lactose or adaptation to certain bacteria or to whatever. And nobody goes around saying, "Hey, I'm type A. And you're type B, so we really can't be seen together." I mean, that would be nuts, because it's invisible.
Right.
But it has no more significance than melanin.
That's true.
It's a you know, an evolved characteristic that differentiates in minor ways one group from another. So my perspective on race, as I think informed pretty strongly by my experiences that you just asked me to talk about.
Yes. And how about the anti-war movement or the support
for
war?
Again, you're asking really good questions, and I'm afraid that I'll just flip out something that I will later think was kind of stupid. certainly, my involvement with people who were then part of what was called the Third World, what was then called the Third World, poor regions of the world, I certainly feel that the business of the horrors that we meted out had a kind of skin color, exotic other. You know, we can bomb them because they're gooks. I'm not sure we'd do Vienna if we felt the Austrians were getting out of line. You know, I just don't, although Bosnia may be an exception to that, but I think that there is this notion, and some people have even alleged about the use of the atomic bomb. I'm not so sure that's true, but the othering of people,
mm-hmm. Yes.
Who I have come to see as, it takes a lot more work to find likenesses if
right.
you're focused on superficial differences. And superficial differences, however, are usually what become signifiers.
Mm-hmm.
What time are we getting to be?
We got time. We've got plenty of time. It's about 4:20 or so.
Yeah, I probably should wrap up.
Okay.
Around, you know, by. I'm not too worried about the weather. I always get caught in the weather. I ride my bike still to sort of stay active. But we should probably wrap up by 5.
Sure.
And if you want to continue. I don't know. I'm impressed, or at least superficially flattered, that you want so much biographical detail in this project. But you're asking extremely good questions as to how I feel experiences have informed other experiences, and that's a tough one to answer in good conscience or off the cuff.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And it's also a kind of challenge to one's own narrative skills. Well, I'd like to give you a good story about how A affected B, and I'm not sure whether it's accurate or just, you know, self-deception. But certainly my view was that the Third World had been exoticized
mm-hmm.
Through these war efforts. And the Iraq is a perfect example, not so much because of skin color, but this idiot, Condoleezza Rice, and those people like her who had these theories about how Arabic-speaking societies in the Middle East are organized were so ignorant. They had no clue of what an endogamous clan was, and had no clue that that's the way a lot of these nations have been structured long before the colonialists drew the boundaries.
Right.
And to go in and say, well, we're going to go fix something.
Yes.
It's like taking a sledgehammer to open a radio so that you can see whether the anode and the diode are working. It's just nuts.
Yes.
And I don't know what kind of incubators these people get their heads into to think we can sit around in Washington or New York or wherever and invent theories about how we fix other societies.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the anthropologist in me. You know, if you don't know how, if you don't understand it, don't mess with it.
Right.
But America, you know, it's the power game too.
Mm-hmm.
Power tends to blind one to, well, we don't really need to understand it because we're going to blow them up.
Right.
It's like, you know, building an airport is a lot easier than building a farming system. You can just drop the cement, put up the windsock, and you got an airport.
Right.
Whereas if you're going to change a farming system, you got to really think, well, what do people live like? It's that kind of problem. And America tends to have seen the world through a power dynamic for so long that I think it's a kind of blindness,
mm-hmm.
which I'm not claiming any super superior insights on this, but when you've had these intimate experiences in other places, you get rather impatient with people sitting around in D.C. in suits.
Right.
Talking about how the other people can benefit from this, that, and the other thing.
Yes. Yes. So you have, you had a very unique experience in that you seem to have been really integrated in all of these movements from a very young age. So none of, how do I phrase this? What am I trying to say? the climate of the time period, that was never sort of a surprise to you, wherever you went, it was sort of...
Right. The movement tends to have been a means for fitting in
mm-hmm.
a certain way in new places.
Right.
I don't want to put words in your mouth, but that's true. I think that when I went to work in South Africa, for instance, I was determined... I knew enough to know that I could get in trouble working in townships where I wasn't supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, what can they do? All they can do is throw me out. So I was, unlike, say, my South African academic colleagues who were very liberal whites at the University of Witwatersrand, were sort of appalled at how snot-nosed I was about the police. And I just go in and out of Soweto. I mean, I got stopped a few times, and they see the U.S. passport. And I, well, you know, it is not American. And so I was a bit insulated, but I still was determined. So I brought African students or African research assistants into the common room of the university, and you could tell these liberals were a little upset that this was being integrated by me and my,
right.
They called them my, Halverson and his slaves, are
wow.
being, you know, sort of roughing up the edges of the university, which had a reputation as a center of integration. But when it came to sort of day-to-day things, bringing Africans in to eat meals in the mm-hmm. common room with the faculty, you could tell a lot of people felt this was pushing the envelope. But I didn't want to, you know, pussyfoot around that.
So this was the university in
Johannesburg.
Johannesburg.
It's the one of the three big universities, Witwatersrand, Cape Town, and Durban, University of Natal.
And this was the second time that you were there? This was the mid-70s?
Both times. Yeah. In the second time, I merely used it as a place where I got camping equipment, and they rented me a Jeep to go out to Botswana, which was about 300 miles away. But I'd come back, say, every 3 or 4 months mm-hmm. and be there for a few days to consult and catch my breath, etc.
Gotcha.
So I was still in connection with people that I knew in South Africa from the first visit, where I was more, you know, there full time.
Now, did you have any, so again, you were rather removed from the situation, I guess, for some time in Vietnam. Did you have any close friends or people you knew who were serving in Vietnam?
I certainly had acquaintances. Close friends, no. But certainly I knew a lot of people who were in Vietnam, yes. But they weren't people that would have hooked back up with me to give me intimate sort of veterans' accounts of what it was like.
Got you. So that was never really... Or I guess you talked about having the decision between McGill and Dartmouth and whether or
yeah.
not your draft number was going to get called, but did it sort of... Was there this shadow over, you know? Was it something that you were actively concerned about a lot, or...
You mean after the... in what period did that... I guess I lost the time thread.
Yes, sorry.
I'm sorry.
So I guess just any, you know, starting at Yale or GW through your time at Dartmouth, you know, a lot of people who weren't directly involved in the war still, you know, very greatly felt
mm-hmm.
sort of a shadow over them because of it. I was just wondering if...
Yes. I felt that it was consuming.
Yes.
A lot of students I don't feel did,
mm-hmm.
that life went on. But there were, I think the, again, you may have read it in the essay, the students who were part of the Back to the Land movement.
Yes.
Here, Jay Guest, Charlie Helmreyer, Steve Tosser, the names that come up in the book, and
mm-hmm.
I mean, you can see their picture, you can identify them. I think that they were just overwhelmed by this phrase I borrowed from Yeats, the center doesn't hold, that we can't really patch this thing together. It's falling apart, and so we will go out and try to create a more cohesive or coherent way of life that has been a thread in American utopian thinking
right.
for a long time. And the Nearings, who lived in Vermont and then moved to Maine, their work was a kind of template for what a lot of the students were trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
There were communes here, like the Wooden Shoe, etc., which I had no central involvement with it all, except I knew people who moved out there.
Right.
And I think for them, the shadow, to use your metaphor, was much bigger than it was for me. I felt that I was doing what I could do better, and it was more important to do it as in the context of teaching than, you know, throwing in the towel and growing crops in Canaan, New Hampshire.
Right. So just for context for the recording, the book that we are referencing is How Many Roads? Photographs of the 60s and Early 70s, put together by Jonathan Sada. Mm-hmm. So you recommended that I flip through this.
See if there was any, you know, it might engender some thoughts that you could find useful.
Yes.
I don't know whether that's true or not, but...
Oh, yeah, I thought it very interesting. Do you have maybe a favorite photograph or anything from the book?
I can tell you one that's the funniest to me. It's a picture of me in there.
Oh, which one is it?
On the steps of Parkhurst with a broken leg, with crutches. And there was a show at the Ava Gallery in Lebanon just two or three months ago. And the Ava Gallery used that photograph to publicize the photography exhibit, which Jonathan put on.
This one?
Yeah, that's me.
Wow.
So I broke my leg skiing, so that's why I was on crutches. So it looks a little more heroic than it actually is. And that's when I alluded to Reeser being on the steps. That's the steps of Parkhurst.
Yes.
So I wouldn't say, that would be a little narcissistic to say that's my favorite photograph. I actually think his cover photograph is very poignant. From the point of view, there's a lot of photographers, one of whom he studied with, who died recently, who does a lot of urban street photography, mm-hmm. where the issue of who's looking at the camera,
right.
is the camera looking at them? I'm not an artist or a photographer, but I think that steely gaze of the young lady straight ahead and the sort of quizzical, maybe a little suspicious look of the guy. I don't even know who they are. Also, the one where the young ladies who were also students at Dartmouth in the exchange program were at the lockup.
This one.
Yeah, right. I think there's several in there that I really do like. The back cover sort of captures some of this wistful, almost innocence of the Back to the Land movement. And I think, you know, he asked me to write the essay because he'd been a student of mine.
And oh, so, gotcha.
And as did Steve Tozer. Mm-hmm. And I don't know whether you know, what's his first name? Teju Cole. He's got quite a reputation as a writer. He wrote the introduction. It's just a short essay. He's a photographer and essayist. He's a Nigerian-American. And he's written two very, very widely reviewed and praised books. Every Day is for the Thief, and there's another one about the city. One is about Lagos, and one is about New York. Anyway, he makes the point, which I think is a good one, that the pictures to him, although he's much too young to remember, he didn't know anything about this, but he says they seem very contemporary in terms of his engagement with the Iraq War. And I think there is a sort of contemporary quality to them if you just translate in your mind how much the Iraq invasion has resonances. Mm-hmm. But we don't have that kind of rebellion because of lack of a draft, among other things. But
right.
I think those pictures do have a kind of timeless quality, but the superficial appearance does require a little help. As I said in my essay, how you see, you know, what do you see is fundamentally a cultural and cognitive question and not just what's depicted in front of you.
Right, and how you interpret what you're
looking at. Yeah, exactly. Every feature of the picture is a stimulus that requires explanation or it becomes a focus of bestowing meaning.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So...
But I think it would be, you know, it's also a little bit of I've tried to write my essay as a kind of, listen, you got to put yourself back. And I wrote it like in the present tense, like news headlines, to show you that this was all piling up.
Yes, yes, yes.
At a tremendous rate. And Yeats's quote, the center doesn't hold, I think really does typify what drove a lot of the Back to the Land piece of it.
So can you explain a little bit, just for context, about the Back to the Land movement?
Wow. Yes, I'm asking me to explain it is overrating what I can do. there was a couple named Nearing, N-E-A-R-I-N-G, who were very active as, they weren't communists, but they were certainly part of the questioning of the industrialization of North America in the 30s and 40s, and decided that too much of the real fundamentals of life were being lost by the hurly-burly and hubbub of the city and the work, and that they felt that you needed, it was a kind of Dewey-esque idea, we've got to live that way to restore these values that are being lost by the anonymization, the atomization of people. And so they did try to build two settlements, one in Vermont and then later in Maine, I believe, which served to some extent as a kind of sleeper, the way Simone de Beauvoir's Second Sex, I think, served as a kind of sleeping document for women who rediscovered it, you know, through Betty Friedan and who's her colleague? I'm blocking on her name. The other big feminist writer of the 70s, Gloria Steinem.
Yes.
So it wasn't that that was taught, but that kind of thinking was around.
Mm-hmm.
And the other books that I cited that I think were had enduring effect that were vilified at the time was Rachel Carson's Silent
yes.
Spring. Simone de Beauvoir's The Second Sex, Betty Friedan's, I forgot the title of her book, those were big.
Mm-hmm.
And I think at a university, having courses deal with that kind of stuff doesn't turn people into hippies or back to the land people, but there are always going to be some people who say, yeah, this is not only interesting, but I want to try this. So Steve Tauzer, who is a very well-known educator. He runs a school in Chicago for school teachers and administrators. Was one of the, he's in there, the big bearded fellow. he was in one of my classes where, and he wrote me after Sada was putting this thing together, and he said, you know, I didn't know the word ecology until I had your class in 1970 or whatever it was. And so just often having an intellectual framework for thinking about issues changes the way, so just good, rational, scientific discussions of topics like environment, race, etc., can demystify it, can defang it.
Yes.
A good Absolutely. Deal. And I think that would be my quick answer to what I now have forgotten exactly was your question.
But the sort of the discussion of the Back to the Land movement.
Back to the Land movement. And I think that the Back to the Land movement was like most movements, a few people adopting in a more personal and action-based way that which is out there as a recipe.
Gotcha.
From other eras even.
So that was more of a removal from society?
Well, yes, it's like Walden. The story gotcha. Is he went out there and lived on his own. Well, it doesn't say that he, every couple of months, took his laundry down the railroad track to his mother's house to wash it and get a shower and a hot meal. So the story takes on a life of its own, and it's not ever
right.
a really accurate description. It's more like a vision.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that they really did work. There were some farms out there in Norwich and in Canaan and so forth that were really scruffy and hard to maintain. And you know, it was, well, you see the pictures.
Yes.
That's hard work.
Yes, absolutely.
There's no question that's hard work. And trying to be pure. Mm-hmm. You know, we're not going to use the car. You know,
right. Well,
these people were not too used to mules. So you still have to make your compromises, and then the VW Beat bus becomes the sort of okay. It's a sign that you're doing your best to tread lightly, that kind of thing.
Got you. So maybe if you,
I think
wanna,
I'm running out of gas.
Yeah,
and maybe running out of things that would be interesting. But are you satisfied with the material you've got?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. Yes.
Is there any?
Yeah.
Point, I mean, real pointed question that you felt has not been asked?
I don't think so.
It seemed to me like, from what I gathered you were saying, that we've covered the ground better than I thought. Well, this nothing like structured questions to help one sound coherent. Otherwise,
it's true.
So the story isn't just free flow. The only thing I would say is that I'm sure if I reflected on your questions, I would revise them, smooth them, which is true of all memory.
Always.
I've actually done a fair amount of work with cultural memory. And it's amazing how we assimilate. The past is always in the present in the sense that the stories we tell are so immersed in the urgent existence of now that it can't be just a look back.
Right, right.
And as long as you know that, and know I'm victim of the same or beneficiary of the same processes. Are you going to do this with other people?
And put together
a collection of...
Yes. So the project itself is a collection of oral histories, people's memories from this
biographically time sort of focused, i.e. what
yes.
this person
exactly.
has to say about this person's personhood.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Interesting.
Exactly.
And is this being done as a course project?
It's a research project that is going to be available online. It's an archive,
mm-hmm.
basically.
And who? What official umbrella is it under? Is it a departmental, or is the college supporting it, or is this just...
I think it's just Dartmouth College is run by two history professors.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Good. Well, but sounds very interesting.
It is. You should check out the rest of it.
I will. Now that I've given my spiel, I'll see what the design is.
Well, thank you so much for talking to me.
Been a pleasure. Good luck to you.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.